floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett. It's time for episode 55 of America's favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. I got a good one this week. Finally got around to editing down and posting my interview with my good buddy Dave Cobb, who when we did this interview, I didn't know at all. I just went in cold. I cold called the guy and went out to Nashville and sat there in his studio, RCA Studio A, legendary place, and talked to him. And that was actually the trip. After that interview, I remember getting back in the car with my buddy Davis, you know, the producer Davis that helps me with this podcast. And we got back in the car, I said, God, I got to make a record with that guy. He's so cool. Sure enough, a few months later, we did that. So it was kind of weird listening back to it now and hearing all this stuff that we talked about that, like, we kind of did. People that he referenced that I didn't know and then wound up playing on my record. And I don't know. The whole thing was cool. It's a trip. It's a good interview. It's been a big week this week. What's going on with you? Arsenal smashed Basel in the Champions League, so that's good. All is right in the world. Theo Walcott, 2 goals. Looking good. Arsenal's on a run, baby. It's going to be our year. We're going to do it. Hillary smashed Trump in the first presidential debates. You know, I'm not Team Hillary. I'm not going to tell you what to think, but gee whiz. That Donald Trump, he is one dumb motherfucker. He is a dumb motherfucker, and it showed. He lost bad. What else is new? Oh, Lance Armstrong's got a fucking podcast now. Can you believe it? Lance Armstrong's got a podcast, and he interviewed Jason Isbell. So it's as if it's not bad enough that that guy beat me 7 times in the Tour de France. What, now he's got to go after my guests? Get your own guests, Lance Armstrong. Let's take a little diversion. Let's talk about my good friends at Zounds.com. Zounds.com. It's where you gotta go when you need music gear. You need a guitar, you need an amp, you need strings or plectrums, guitar straps. Get on your laptop, go to Zounds.com. It's run by real musicians, not a bunch of jerks. They're real musicians. They'll give you a payment plan if you need it. They'll get it to you fast, whatever. Zounds.com, come on, it's the best. All right, here we go.
Early in the morning before the sun comes up, wood burning in the stove, coffee stirring in his cup. He's chomping at the bits to get us youngins at the bed. Check the baskets at the creek, get the hogs and chickens fed.
Dave Cobb has been producing your favorite bands since the late 90s, with 40-plus records to his name so far. He's worked with everyone from Shooter Jennings to Jamie Johnson to Jason Isbell to Chris Stapleton to his dad's favorite, the Oak Ridge Boys. And of course, he even produced my latest solo record. But this interview was done back in April, before we really knew each other. The same week that he took over the legendary Nashville recording studio, RCA Studio A. The house that Chet Atkins built. Where artists like Dolly Parton, Elvis Presley, and Waylon Jennings, just to name a few, recorded some of their biggest hits. In addition to his producing duties, Dave's been quietly building an empire, complete with a publishing company and a record label, Low Country Sound, which released the compilation album Southern Family earlier this year. Let's hear what he had to say about his path from growing up in Southern Georgia to moving out to Los Angeles to embracing his Southern roots and settling down out in Nashville, where he says if he was ever an outsider, it's just because he didn't know anybody yet. Well, he knows a few people now. This is Dave Cobb on Walking the Floor.
Daddy Walk the Line, Jerry Reed, Amos Moses was cutting this room. Eddie Arnold, Make the World Go Away, The Monkees recorded here, Elvis recorded here. I mean, it keeps going, man. I know about a fraction of what was done here, actually.
So how did it wind up in your hands?
Ben Folds had been leasing it for about 14 years, and he decided to go be near his daughter in upstate New York. And so he moved there, and the place came up, and I'd made friends with the owner of the building, and he called me on a Saturday morning and said, you know, hey, Ben's going to New York. You want the place? And I was like, absolutely, I'll take it. No thought, nothing. And he called me back 5 minutes later. He's like, are you sure? And I was like, of course, man. He's like, call me the next morning. Same thing. Are you sure? So, I mean, it's a lot to take in. I mean, you can't really see this place, you know, through a microphone, but it's shocking.
Like so many great studios, it's totally nondescript from outside.
Yeah.
Like when we pulled up, I was like, is this the historic Studio A? What?
It's crazy.
And then you walk in and it's, I mean, I wish people could see what I'm seeing right now, but it's
nuts. It's nuts. And it's a bit overwhelming, you know, to be in a place like this.
How much of this is original?
It's all original. There was a drum booth over there in the staircase added, I think, in the 90s, but everything, I mean, this is original. These are the original walls. You know, they painted them black, but they were white. But this is pretty damn original.
Well, obviously, if you've only been here a week, you didn't make your new record here. So where'd you do that? Where'd you do Southern Family?
Southern Family, a lot of it actually was done here.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this was a commercial studio.
Oh,
Ben
right.
was leasing it out.
So
yeah.
you just came in.
Yeah, we did a lot of stuff here. We did Traveler. Chris Stapleton Traveler.
Oh,
here.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It was cut right here. We did a lot of the Southern Family. Did the Miranda Lambert track here. Brandy Clark here off the record. Morgan Stapleton and Chris Stapleton we did here for this. Sergio and I recorded here before. Had Isbel here doing something recently too. So I recorded here off and on for a little while. But
and did you also have your own studio here in town somewhere?
Yeah, I got a little tiny ass studio in the back of my house, you know, like everybody else. But it's tiny, and it's where we did most of my records in the back of the house, man. It was no pressure.
How did you get your new album together? Like from when I look at something like that with all those incredible musicians on it, like my first thought is, from what I know about being in a band or being around musician people, how the hell did you coordinate that? That just looks like
man,
a nightmare.
It was a nightmare actually. It's something I don't think I'll ever do again. You know,
right?
But I pulled every favor I had with everybody. I feel like I'm out of favors forever.
You got to go run up some more favors.
I pulled every favor. I mean, there's nothing. You know, I can't ask somebody for a piece of chewing gum at this point after suckering everybody to be on the same record. But you know. There was a record I loved called White Mansions, written by an English guy, Paul Kennerly, produced by Glenn Johns. It had Waylon Jennings and Jesse Coulter on it, and Eric Clapton was playing on the record as well. And that record I've been forcing on people forever. Mm. You know, actually, I moved to California when I was 27, and I never listened to country music growing up. It was in my house, but I wanted to listen to AC/DC and Van Halen and Led Zeppelin and anything but country music. And I met Shooter Jennings out in California, and he turned me on to that album, White Mansions. And the moment I heard that record, that was the beginning of the end of me just diving headfirst into country. And all of a sudden, it made sense, you know? So ever since I've heard that record the first time, I force it on everybody. I always make people listen to it.
You know what? You're forcing it on me right now, and I'm happy to have it forced on me because I've never even heard of it.
Oh, man. So that's the inspiration for Southern Family was that concept record.
But how did you get, because most of the songs are originals on it, right?
How
did you get everybody to...
Well, I just asked them, I wanted to write, somebody said you should make a concept record, and I said, this sounds like a terrible idea, it'll never work, and I kind of laughed it off. And I was in a hotel room in New York, and it came to me the concept of Southern Family, because everybody got a story about their grandparents, their brothers or sisters, cousins, children. And I wanted songs to be written really personal songs that maybe they wouldn't include on their record.
Mm.
It's not aiming for singles. We're not aiming to sell records. We're not aiming to do anything but, as a pure art piece. And I think people got excited about, not being caged and just being able to just let it out. And I asked Jason Isbell early on about it. And he's like, yeah, man, I'll do it.
I love his song. Oh,
man.
So great.
He freaks me out. It takes me like 3 or 4 years to understand that dude's lyrics.
Right.
He's such a sharp writer with a pen. I'll literally get some.
He's
of the
guy
songs.
That every time you listen to me, you go, God damn, I wish I thought of that. That's
I know,
so good.
I know, man. I know he gets me bad. And then I asked the Stapletons if they would be interested in doing it, and they said yeah. So it kind of became really easy, And once I had a couple people in on it, I asked people I didn't know, like John Paul White. From the Civil Wars, I was a big fan of his voice. So I went down to Muscle Shoals to see him and somehow suckered him into doing it. And then, people came on like Miranda Lambert at the end of it. I'd made the record. I never reached out to her because, she's a superstar and I didn't know her. And, in my head, it was no way she would ever do something like this.
Right.
Even though I was a big fan of hers. And I'd always thought she made really honest records, And so I ran into her socially one time, and she saw me, and she's like, I heard about your stupid record. What, I'm not cool enough to be on it? And so, of course, we got her on it after that, and I feel like an idiot, but yeah, man, it was a lot of favors and a lot of people giving up their one day off they had
right.
in 3 months, you know,
to
do it. And I think people were really excited about being on a record together too, you know?
Right.
That's what was cool. It's like, you know, these people hang out with each other. They're social with each other. So it's kind of a good excuse to kind of powwow and get together, really.
And you played on it as well as producer, right?
By default.
Were you involved in like helping put the songs together with the different
people?
Well, you
know, all those writers are so good.
Right.
You know, I mean, when I'm around all of them, I'm kind of auxiliary, whatever needs to be there. But yeah, I played on it really by default, you know. Mm. I like trying to capture as much going down live as possible.
Sure.
You know, and
you got a big room here to put a lot of people here to
do it. Yeah, yeah. But I just think, I don't know, something happens when that human interaction happens when everybody's playing together as opposed to piecemealing it that I prefer. So I don't really care about doing overdubs, so I played by default, you know? If it's a shaker, if it's a guitar, if it's, you know, triangle, whatever, I'll just sneak in there and do it.
It's interesting. You said Miranda Lambert was like, hey, am I not cool enough to be on your record? And, you know, you do have, like, a reputation as being, you know, like, working with a lot of, you're here in Nashville, but, like, outside, people that are outside the mainstream of the sort of, you know, current country world or whatever. Right. I'm like stumbling over this question, but but when I look at your album, and you know, obviously you made the Chris Stapleton record, which is a huge record, and, and then on this record you got Miranda and Zach and people like that. How much overlap here in town? I know there's the perception of that for people like me that are outside of town, that there's this camp over here and there's this camp over here and this camp, but is that accurate?
You know, I, to be honest with you, if I was ever faulted for being outside the country camp here in town, it's just because I didn't know anybody.
Right.
You know, I really didn't know anybody. You know, I moved from California and, you know, started my career out there, really. And I just didn't know anybody. So the people that I met, you know, when I moved to town, like working with Jason Isbell or Sturgill, they're friends of mine.
Right.
And we didn't know anybody. So I think it was never a purposeful split between commercial country music and what we do. It's just, I don't think we knew anybody.
Right.
You know? And
how was that moving to town? Because, you know, Nashville is a place that has a reputation as being hard to break in. Like, it's a tight knit music community that's hard to establish yourself in. And was that
I never got treated bad. I never got thrown out of the system again. Cause I didn't know anybody. So, you know, I don't know. I never felt like there was a wall. I didn't try to break in a wall. I just made records and kind of kept my head down. You know, in my mind, the best records are like a Wilco record.
Mm.
Like, if I could make a record that sells enough to have a band that lasts for years and years and years and go and play theaters that's, you know, 2,500 seat theater, I think that's the ultimate
sell enough
thing
to be able to make.
So I think I make records the same way. And unfortunately we've been able to do some of that, but, yeah, man, I don't know. I don't feel like there are any walls up, and I feel like Nashville is actually really embracing, you know, Chris Stapleton now, and really embracing, you know, Isbell. Isbell went number one country as well in Billboard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
with the success of guys like Stapleton and Isbell, and now Sturgill's got that new record out that's, I'm assuming, doing well, that came out the other day that everyone's talking about. Do you think that the sound that you're known for having a hand in creating, that is a little outside of like what mainstream country is doing these days, do you think that that's going to reflect back onto mainstream country?
I mean, I would argue that Chris Stapleton is now mainstream country.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, sure.
So I think, you know,
but I guess I mean that more in the sense of like people that are already established.
You know what I hear all the time?
You know, it's like Florida Georgia Line going to start trying to ape your guitar sounds and stuff like that.
I don't know, man. I think I think to make these records, you kind of got to listen to the records we copied, you know?
Right. What are the records you copied? What are the records, like, I was curious who the producers in particular are.
Oh,
who,
man,
you try to emulate.
Yeah, Glyn Johns, for sure. I mean, I love Stone's albums that he did, and his brother Andy as well, Sticky Fingers and Exile on Main Street and Let It Bleed and, you know.
All the Mick Taylor years.
And anything Jimmy Miller did. Yeah. Jimmy Miller was the producer on that stuff. I love all that. And obviously, the Beatles, they're my favorite band of all time.
Yeah.
The Faces and Small Faces and The Who. And
Are those bands that you grew up listening to?
Yeah, man. I know it sounds messed up being from South Georgia listening to that. But to me, it was like, you know, fantasy land to listen to some English band from far, far away. And,
sure.
I don't know. I love the feeling and the danger and the rock and roll in those records. So I think I think when I make country records, it's I'm probably hearing, you know, a Blind Faith song in the back of my head, you know, like Can't Find My Way Home or something, when I'm trying to make a deep down country song.
Right.
If that makes any sense at all.
Absolutely.
You know? So
I'm struck when I listen to the records you make at how you do that kind of magic thing of your, like, your records have that old school flavor to it, but still sound current. You know what I mean? Your records don't sound retro. It doesn't sound like, right. Like, I don't know, it would be an example, like a Jellyfish record or something. That's really
love that
blatantly...
band. That was one of my inspirations, too.
Well, you know, I mean, they're a great band. I don't mean that like, derivative, but like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it doesn't sound like we're going to try to make this sound exactly like 1972.
Well, I don't
like,
think we can. I don't think we have enough cocaine to do to make them sound. Oh,
yeah, we could get it.
Yeah, well, let's try. Yeah, I don't know. I'm influenced by a lot of new records, too, you know, and I think it's fun mixing them all up. You know, when we were doing the Sturgill Metamodern record, I mean, all the crazy stuff that sounds like it's EDM is done with 60s tape effects, you know?
Right.
You put Ride in the faders, making them freak out, like as if it was a modern turntable doing it or something, but it's all done with 60s kind of effects. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's...
Tape delays.
Here, you know, listen, I'm 41 years old, so... You know, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with UTFO and Run DMC and, you know, and stuff like that. I think all that stuff kind of filters in somehow, too, you know?
Sure. So is this, is the Southern Family record, is that the first release on your label?
The first release is a guy, Anderson East, that came out right before that. And we have another new guy, Brent Cobb, which is my little cousin, coming out, too. Super, he's like the redneck Paul Simon. He's killer.
When I saw his name on your record, I was like, that must be his brother.
Yeah, no, he's my little bitch-ass cousin. Yeah.
What possessed you to start your own label at the time in music history when labels have been on
well,
such a downward
fun,
slide
right?
For
so
long.
I don't have to impress a lot of people right now. That's the fun thing about doing it.
It's, right.
I don't know, man. It's just, you know, my whole life has been working with people before they get record deals, and then they get the record deal, and hopefully they do well. You know, like Sturgill's a great example. It's like, you know, I met Sturgill and he just had a great voice, so we went and made records for no other reason than make the record, and now he's, you know, on Atlantic Records. So it's great to have a home for something I work with early. It's really great. I don't have to like go shop it around or anything like that.
Are you involved in the business side as well as the creative? Like, are you A&Ring it? And
well, technically, I don't. You know, back in the day, George Martin was the A&R, the record label, the producer. So I don't have to do any of the financial stuff, and I don't have to do any of the logistics. I think for me, it's all just completely creative. So if it was anything other, I can't do math. So I'd feel sorry for anybody signing with me if I had to write their check. They'd probably never, it'd be the wrong amount every time.
When you make records here, do you have like your own in-house kind of your own wrecking crew?
Definitely. And it's funny, they're Californians. They're a couple
really?
Of guys I met out there, yeah.
Who
there's it's two guys that I really consider the kind of core. I play guitar, and then there's a guy, Brian Allen, plays bass, and another guy, Chris Powell, and I met them in California, and we started working together out there. And one of the first things we did is I got a call from Jamie Johnson, and he just wanted to get together and record a little bit. So we wound up recording about 17 songs that became two records. It became a couple songs in that lonesome song, and the double record we have seven songs on that.
Oh, nice!
And Jamie hired the drummer on the spot, and hired the other guitar player from that session, and moved them here. So I lost my whole crew. That's why I had to move, man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, man. They're great. I mean, we study that stuff like textbooks. I mean, we study everything from Stax and Muscle Shoals to the Wrecking Crew itself. You know, Hal Blaine is one of my favorite drummers of all time. So
did you watch that documentary?
Of course.
Oh,
yeah,
so
devastating.
Good,
yeah. But you know, the drummer, I literally beat him up for years making him watch Hal Blaine. So he can be Hal Blaine, you know.
Oh,
it's
really?
Crazy. Yeah,
wow.
It's nuts. So
that's amazing that you found, like, you've cobbled together a crew of guys,
man,
that have the same, you know, obsession as you.
Well, I have a theory about record making. I think people are so obsessed with vinyl these days. Vinyl. Everything's vinyl. And I'm totally cool with that. I love the experience of picking up a record and looking at it and looking at the pictures on the inside. But I think what people really crave is not just the sound of vinyl albums. I think they crave the humanity of those vinyl albums.
Sure, and, yeah, of course.
You know, you just speak of the Wrecking Crew. Those records sound so good.
Yeah.
Because they were professionals in a professional studio, and these guys
were ringers.
This is the
thing I always tell people when people talk about modern recording techniques and stuff. I'm like, you know, it's great. I had GarageBand on a laptop when I was 15 instead of a Fostex 4-track,
yeah,
that would have been great. But it's still, that's never going to replace having an incredible room with a bunch of guys that really know how to use the board and, like, you know, professionals. Like
they were professionals.
You can't
replace
that.
No. And that's the sound. Right. I mean, that really is the sound. The sound is not made in the control room. The sound is made by the players.
Right.
But, you know, Nashville had it with the Nashville A team. LA had it with the Wrecking Crew. Motown had it with, you know, the Funk Brothers. So Stax had it with their guys, with Steve Cropper and all those guys. So I think that's the key to making those records sound great, you know, is awesome players, awesome singers. You had to be pretty professional to make it into a studio at that point. So
you couldn't fake it.
Yeah.
Are there enough of those guys left here in town that have you gotten to work with some of those cats?
Definitely. There's a guy, Hargus Pig Robbins, we use on records. We used it on Sturgill's record. And I've used him on other things, and he was part of the original Nashville A team.
Oh, really?
You know, Floyd Kramer and him were the two main piano players.
Right.
That played on everybody's record. I think first session Pig did was George Jones' White Lightning in 57 it was.
And he's still around recording?
He's blind as a bat and just ridiculous. He can outplay anybody. But I was watching him play. The first time I ever used him was on a session. He was just sitting there, just laying in the track. And then when he hit his solo, it jumped up 10 dB. And it sounded like a record. I figured it out right then and there. It had nothing to do with technology. I mean, these guys were trained. You know, this guy also played
on... He was mixing himself.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And the guy, he was also on Nashville Skyline and Blonde on Blonde. Mm. I mean, he's just bad to the bone. So, right. And as a matter of fact, I got to produce George Jones shortly before he died. And I had Pig on the session. And it was awesome to see those two play together. Because he also played on... He stopped Love or Her Today and everything like that. He played all the way through those eras.
Wow.
And it's funny, two guys cutting up like children again. You know, I just said, George, you know, you see that piano player in there? And he looked at him. He's like, nah. I'm like, George, you look closely. He's like, I don't know who it is. I'm like, George is Pig. He's like, that motherfucker.
He owes me $5.
Exactly. Right. Those guys are still children at 80 years old. They acted like little
kids. What was
kids.
That like to work with George Jones?
Oh, man. It's, you know, he's funny. First of all, he's hilarious. You know, I guess I worked with him. Maybe it was 6-7 months before he died. Mm. Funny.
Did you ever read his book?
No,
Live to
man.
Tell It All or something?
No, I can only imagine.
I read Johnny Cash's autobiography, which is all sort of like redemption and wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, I lived this way.
Right.
It was wrong. I learned these lessons.
Did George just tell you how to get out of a DUI riding a lawnmower? Was that a lesson
exactly
there?
Like, George Jones was so, I was like laughing out loud. And I don't think it was written as comedy, but it was so funny because the gist of it was kind of like, you know, hey man, if that guy hadn't given me that bag of coke, I wouldn't have, you know, crashed into that police car. What, you know, it was insane.
I heard a funny story recently, and I'll keep people's names out of it, about George Jones going up to another famous country artist's house, and they were having dinner, and at the end of the dinner, you know, he was drinking a ton of dinner. He's like, I'm gonna go get me some ice cream. And people looked at him, was like, you know, George, why don't you hang out here? We got ice cream in the fridge, you know? He's like, no, I'm going to get my damn Baskin Robbins. I gotta have my Baskin Robbins. And he's like, man, we got ice cream here. You don't need to be driving. And apparently, George's like, fuck you. And he threw a punch and missed the guy. And so I guess two or three other country artists, they tied him to a chair, kept him there overnight. And apparently my friend walked downstairs in the morning, sees George Jones tied to a chair, kind of passed out.
Awesome.
He wanted to kill people over ice cream, over Baskin Robbins, but he gets up, he wakes up, looks around, he's like, my bad.
Whoops.
My bad. But he was that kind of, you know, he was a wild man from what I hear. I love it. I love
you must be at a point in your career now where, like, a lot of the people that you are a fan of, probably, I'm assuming, are coming to want to work with you.
I got a couple calls from stuff like that, but to be honest with you, I'm really excited about working with new artists.
Right.
You know, I think it's always fun to, you know, life hasn't gotten in the way. They're not jaded. You know, they're just excited.
Eager to be there.
I like that. To me, that's a ton of fun. I mean, listen, there's a lot of people I'd love to make, but I could, you know, my hero is Paul McCartney, probably, of anybody. I'd be scared to work with Paul McCartney. I can't remake, you know, Revolver.
Can you do that, you know, one more time a little better, Paul?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I can't do it. I can't remake Revolver. I couldn't beat Maybe I'm Amazed, you know? You know, not just a competition, but, you know, I like to find who's new and who's young.
I was really blown away when I was doing research for this interview. I didn't realize how many records you've already produced. I mean, the thing that I read said like 40 plus records.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
You're telling me
it's a
something.
Lot of records, man.
I guess so.
When did you start producing?
Probably about...
Because I know you were in a band prior to
that. Probably, I don't know, 1999, 2000, something like that.
And that was out in LA?
No, it was in Atlanta.
Oh, okay. Oh, really?
Yeah, I moved from Atlanta to Los Angeles in end of 2002. And
was that with your band? What was...
No, my band was kind of breaking up. We were, you know, we had a bad record deal. Imagine that. Yeah. And we're kind of stuck. And so I started recording friends of mine. And then those bands got attention. And I moved to L.A. And when I first moved to L.A., I met Shooter Jennings because we were both from the South. And mm-hmm. somebody said, you guys are both from the South. You get along. And we did his first record. And there was a song called 4th of July that did really, really well on country radio. And the record did pretty well. So I kept meeting other country people and starting to come to Nashville a lot. So,
right.
Yeah, but I moved out there to rock.
That Oak Ridge Boys record.
Oh, man.
That you worked on with Seven Nation Army. I was like, I was just listening to some stuff that you'd work on. That was the one I was like, what the fuck? That's amazing.
Well, that was the whole point.
So
wasn't
good,
it?
Man.
That was the whole point. I thought it was
How'd
fun.
How'd you talk? Did they have any idea
who the
White Stripes were?
No. Do you know who Bill Gaither is?
No.
Okay, Bill Gaither, he's like the number one figure in gospel music, period. Number one, you know, famous, kind of runs the whole world. They were signed to a Christian label. And when we did the record, I thought it was so fun to do the song. Bill Gaither walks in as we're recording Seven Nation Army. And one of the guys from the Oak Ridge Boys goes, Bill, what do you think about this? And Bill looks at him and he's like, I don't know what it is, but I like it. And then, you know, like 75-year-old guy just like getting into it.
So
they loved
great.
It. They had fun with it, man. They had a blast with it. And I, you know, I did that. That was actually one of the groups that I grew up with. You know, I grew up, my grandmother was a Pentecostal minister, so we had a lot of gospel stuff around. Mm. And my dad loved the Oak Ridge Boys. It was his favorite. You know, it's like his number one favorite, Elvis and the Oak Ridge Boys. And so I did it because I'd grown up with it, and it was the greatest thing in the world to get to know those guys. And then I was still living in California, and my dad was out in California, and I got to take him to a show, and he got to go on the Oak Ridge Boys bus.
Really?
And they gave him a jacket that said his name on it. It was like
it's
like better than, you know, anything in the world, like your dad, you know, recognizing, you know, one of the artists you work with.
That's an incredible story. That's cool. Let's actually go back. How did you get into music? Like when you were a kid, what was your introduction to music?
Well, you know, man, I've always wanted to be in a band. I mean, since I can remember, I never had any other back out plans, you know. I was always in bands. I had bands in grade school. My grandfather was a bluegrass musician, so, you know, I'd go to spend time with him and hear him play, and gave me a guitar really early. And my grandmother on the other side, the preacher, she had published songs, so there's a little bit of music around. But overall, man, I don't know why, I just was always attracted to it. There's something about it I could listen to, you know. At the time, obviously, as a child, I didn't smoke pot, but I feel like when I listen to records, I can't drive and listen to records still to this day.
Really?
I cannot listen to records and drive. I'll wreck.
Right.
Yeah, I just go into this other world. Go into this other world on it. And I don't know. It's always had a big hold on me ever since I heard the Beatles. I think my aunt was left a Beatles album at the house, and that was it, man. Day in the Life, I think that song was the first song I heard. And it's a lot to take in as a five-year-old, and you know, you can get obsessed with it. So.
I love, like, because I had the same experience where I had older brothers.
So yeah.
They had Beatles and Stones and Bowie and stuff like that. And when you're that young, because I mean, those are really my earliest memories, being like three and like looking at Hard Day's Night or whatever.
Definitely.
And you just, you know, the way you process it is so innocent that you have no reference points.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like when you go back as an adult and listen to a lot of those records, it's, you're like, oh, okay, I see what they actually meant. But
you know what's funny is with records like that, I listen to Beatles albums rarely now because I wore them out way too much, but I listen to them and I still can't. I know as a producer and an engineer, I understand how they were made, but when I listen to them, I can't put it all together. Like, I can't imagine how they actually did it.
Right.
I love records like that. You listen to them, you're like, you have no idea. Like, I know it was four guys in a room making a record,
right?
But when you listen to it, it sounds like it's from outer space.
Totally.
And I can't even imagine human beings making records like, you know, Hunky Dory, Bowie, or, you know, Revolver, or you know, or even Alice Cooper, Billion Dollar Baby. I can't imagine how those records were made. I know how they were made, but it doesn't make sense in my head. I love that.
The one for me is Elvis's version of Blue Moon. Whatever they put on his vocal, it's got to be like a tape delay or something.
Ampex 300
like it's
or
from
something. Yeah.
Freaking Mars.
Like, oh, I know. That's the best records. Always. Yeah. Always. Love it.
So when did you start actually playing?
I started taking lessons at four.
And what were you playing? Because aren't you a bit of a multi-instrumentalist?
Yeah. I started taking guitar, and I remember guitar hurt my fingers. So my mom's already paid for lessons. So I took drum lessons, so I started playing drums. So I was serious about drums and played drums all through school. And when I got about 12, I started playing bass, you know, because I wanted to write songs. I couldn't really, I used to call girls on the phone, try to play songs through them, you know, playing drums and singing, you know, whatever it took, you know, whatever it took. You know, I wanted to write songs. I started playing bass, and about a year later, I switched to guitar. So I've been playing guitar since 13, so
okay.
I suck at everything else.
And what about bands? What were your first bands like?
Oh man, my first band was a Beatles cover band. You know,
really?
Yeah, man.
That's a tall order when you're 13.
Yeah, and
I was playing
Paul too.
Really?
I'm sure.
How old were you?
My first serious band was about 12.
Okay.
And it sucked. It was terrible. You know, had
they
bunch
always
of,
the first.
They
one
were all
years,
yeah,
right?
yeah. Anything? I remember making the T-shirts and everything, and it was like a ripoff. You know how Led Zeppelin has the Zeppelin crashing the Hindenburg?
Yeah.
Ours was like a boat sinking.
Nice.
You know, so bad. You know, anything to rip off Zeppelin, I could. Yeah.
It's funny, man. I recently went around to a bunch of guys that I played with in high school.
Oh wow.
And got, because I never had, like, you know, when we were kids, nobody filmed anything. It's not like today.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything's filmed. But there was a few videos of that somebody made with a camcorder. I got my ninth grade talent show, which was my first gig.
Oh God.
Then I got a gig when I was with some of the same guys when I was in like the 10th grade, and then one from maybe like 11th grade, 12th grade, somewhere around there. And it's so rad to watch.
Oh man, I'd love to see that.
The evolution, like it's just cacophonous noise to pretty bad and stiff and weird. And then by like 12th grade, you're like, all right, man. We're kind of a rock band, man. What's happening?
Man, I don't think there's anything better than the feeling of being in a band and I don't know what it was like for you in California, but getting dropped off at your friend's house and go practice in that garage, plugging into that crappy amp and just, you know, I don't know, running a Zeppelin song really, really poorly, but that feeling always sticks with me. It's like, you know, I've never done cocaine, but I compare it to like doing cocaine the first time. It's never as good the second, but I'm always chasing that feeling, that first feeling of going over to the friend's house and
all those first
cranking
feels,
up.
It's like the first time you ever play a gig, for me, it was my talent show. The first time you played a keg party like girls talk to you and you got free beer.
Oh man.
And I remember the first time I played in a bar. And I walked off stage, and I was 16, you know, and I'd never been in a bar, I don't think, up to that point. I walked off, and the bartender cracked open a beer for me and set it on the bar.
Oh, man.
And I was like,
that was it, right?
Whoa, is this for real? And I drank it and finished it and put it back, and he opened another one and replaced it. I was like, dude, this is
you figured it out.
Man.
You figured it all out. Yeah, man, you're right. You're right.
So how did you go from you know, whatever, huge music fan, playing in bands growing up, to then getting a record deal? And
I had done
some records.
I mean, I was always messing around with, you know, it's funny. I told somebody this story the other day. It's not a very good story, but there was a guitar I wanted so bad. And it was 1987, a Kramer Beretta. This pink,
I remember. It might
pink
have been a Kramer Striker.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Everybody wanted those pointy guitars in the 80s.
Yeah, and they all came with whammy bars on.
Yeah, I wanted one so bad. And so I kept putting pictures all around the house. And Christmas time came up. And I look under the tree and there's a Kramer box. I'm thinking, oh man, I got the guitar. They can't believe it. They bought me the guitar. And I opened it up and there was no guitar in there. It was the worst.
Practical joke.
Yeah, it was a practical joke. But what there was in the bottom of the box was a four track, a Tascam four track.
So,
you know, I actually at that time could care less about it because I wanted that stupid guitar with the pointy headstock.
Yeah.
But, you know, I started messing around with recording then and always in bands playing around. And, an engineer I met in town, in Atlanta, this guy Darren Prindle, invited me to play on a record he was doing for Jermaine Dupri. Sorry, for Dallas Austin. So I did a few sessions for Dallas Austin, started getting in that, doing session stuff, and then I got to do a session for Jermaine Dupri. And I was always around the studio scene in Atlanta. So that's when I really fell in love with the studio thing. And about the same time, my band got signed, and so we toured a lot and we're on the radio.
Why aren't those records in Spotify?
No, I don't want them to be on Spotify. No. No, man. So we got, you know, I did the band thing for a while and bad record deal, blah, blah, blah. And I'd recorded the demos that one of our songs was on the radio and everything. And I'd recorded it, not produced it, but recorded it. And Jack Joseph Puig mixed it. And we were big fans of Jellyfish. So, So I was kind of was into it. But it wasn't until the band was kind of falling apart. And a friend of mine is an engineer. He's like, man, you're either going to be in a band or you're going to make records. You can't do both. It's really hard to split your mind. And so I decided I wanted to be home. I'd met my wife at that point. I never saw her because I was on tour all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And, man, I just loved being in the studio the most about being in a band. That was always the fun part about it to me. And so from that point on, I started getting serious about it. And being in the studio was like being in a different band every few weeks, which I thought was super cool and fun, and learning about different genres of music. So then I got serious, and a manager kind of approached me and said, come out to L.A. He had a label. I'd be the staff guy, and I get out to L.A., and the guy disappears on me. And kind of had to struggle how to figure out how to survive. We spent every
That's
money.
That's
kind
of a classic story.
Yeah. We spent.
I didn't even know they still had like staff producers. And
well, apparently they didn't. I figured it out when I got out there. But yeah, I was broke in LA and just had to like figure out how to do it. Yeah, wing it. And then shortly after, I met Shooter and we had a hit record, and you know, been doing it seriously ever since.
And so, what brought you back to Nashville then? I
have a daughter, and she was born in LA, and I just wanted her to kind of be able to run and play in a neighborhood and things like that. That's part of it. But the selfish reason is because I felt like when I was in Nashville, there was so much music here. Mm. You know, LA is amazing. I mean, the studios are incredible and there's a lot of incredible bands and talent, but there's a lot of different industries. When you come to Nashville, it feels like it's music.
Right.
Everything is music.
You've got the music business in LA, but really it's the entertainment business.
Exactly.
It's really, it's movies. And
yeah,
TV,
yeah.
Totally. That's the big piece of the pie.
But it felt like every time I was here, I was really inspired. And shortly before I got serious about moving here, I had heard this band I work with, Rival Sons, they played me Chris Stapleton's old band, Steel Drivers, through an iPhone. When I heard Chris sing, I was like, Jesus, I got to go find that guy.
Yeah.
And about the same time, a band I was working with out there, they played me Outfit by the Drive-By Truckers. Mm. And that song just knocked me out, man. Because that's exactly how you feel growing up in the Southeast.
Really?
Yeah. Like every word, I got really homesick. And I was playing my daughter all these country records, you know, next to her crib. And I don't know, I started getting obsessed with it and just missing home a lot, you know?
Yeah.
And so it just made sense to kind of come here. And, you know, shortly after I got here, I did meet those guys and get to work with them. So it was kind of I felt like in my mind, if I was in the right place, the right time, then maybe good things would happen. So that's why I came to Nashville.
And do you ever miss being in a band? Like, do you think you'll ever be in a band or make a, you know,
I don't
put
think,
a band together?
I don't think so at all. But it's fun. I've been getting to live out, you know, the band thing a little bit with Chris Stapleton. I played on the record, and he did a CD release show, and he asked me to come out and play with him. So I did it, and we had a blast. And then he asked me to play at a couple other shows. I did it and had a blast. And I went on, you know, rode with him for a couple days, had a blast. And I've done TV with him. So I get to be in a band when it's fun, you know, which is great. And so I love playing with him. You know, hearing his vocal come out of the monitor. I mean, shit, yeah, there's not a whole lot of singers better. Oh, man.
How did he find you? Like, correct me if I'm wrong here, but didn't he sort of get a start as a songwriter?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he's had a lot of big cuts.
For a lot of like mainstream big
hit
type
stuff.
Absolutely. So how come he wanted to make a record that didn't sound like that?
Well, I don't think he didn't really have the pressure on him to, like, as an artist, that was purely a passion thing for him. You know, he made his living songwriting, so he just wanted to be selfish and make a, I'm speaking for him, I don't know if this is true, but he just wanted to make a record that he loved, you know? And he had heard Sturgill Metamodern. I think he says you know, got halfway through the first song, he's like, who's the guy who did this? Who's involved with this? And so we met and did a little trial thing and jumped in the studio shortly afterwards. And here we are.
Can we talk a little bit about sort of the technical side of things?
We've sure.
Got to nerd out a little bit.
Yeah, all right.
People like
Let's
that
go.
Stuff. How do you get the sounds that you get? What is your sort of, you know, your, what's the technical side of that? Because it sounds to me when I listen to your records, like there's a lot of layering of instruments and stuff, maybe two different things playing the same line, like a 12 string and a mandolin. There's like some crazy shit going on.
Maybe that's
if I'm hearing that right.
Maybe that's with the Mellotron. I combine sounds on that sometimes. But I mean, really, I think the sound is in the room. And I spend a lot of time listening to records and, you know, you hear a snare drum in real life, you're like, man, that doesn't sound like a snare drum on the record.
Right.
And then I kept listening to this stuff and hanging around people that were smarter than me until I figured out that's the snare drum to get that sound, or that's the guitar that gets that sound, or that's the hi-hat that sounds like that record. And I think I chased a lot of the instruments and a lot of the gear.
Really?
To make, you know, similar sounds to records that I loved. And
well, just looking around this room, I mean, obviously you have again, people listening to this podcast can't see what I'm seeing, but you have some amazing stuff here. Those amps in particular over there that Davis is hiding.
Oh yeah, So I think, you know, to get the sounds, you start researching, you know, how did David Gilmour get that sound? And you start reading. Obviously, it's David Gilmour's hands. He could play, you know, a Mexican right. Strat and a crate, and it would sound amazing. But, you know, you start researching all that stuff, and then you start researching all the country guys and what they played. And so I think I traced a lot of that gear, because I think the sound happens in the room.
I was amazed when I look back at some old pictures and stuff, because I always think, you know, old honky tonk, it's a Tele through a Fender Deluxe or whatever.
They were playing Gretsches. They were playing all kinds of everything.
Stuff. Yeah, rights and just weird guitars that you never heard of. And
yeah, man.
What are your go to like guitars, amps, pedals? What are the things that you lean on a lot?
Probably my favorite guitar I've got is an old '59 Gretsch Firebird Jet. Mm. I love it. It sounds like a really thick.
It's not that old, but it's the Malcolm Young guitar, right?
Well, yeah, it's like that, but the single cutaway instead of the double.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's the same guitar. Just,
right.
Yeah, man, it's something about that thing just resonates with me.
Does that thing have the microphonic pickups or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
You can record vocals?
Yeah, pretty much. It just sounds like a really thick Tele. I like that thing a lot. And you can become AC/DC or you can become, you know, Buck Owens, depending on what day it is. So I like that. And I like this guy, Alexander Dumble, made me an amp. And it's just those two together. It's kind of it.
I've never played through one of those, but that's one of those boutique-y names that you always hear about.
But it sounds like a really high fidelity Fender in a great way, you know?
Right.
So, but yeah, that's we can go on for days about this junk. So we should probably go to another topic. A lot of stuff.
What about pedals?
Pedals, man, my favorite pedal of all time is a '60s Vox Tonebender. I think that's kind of it, because I learned when you turn the volume, we turn the pedal all the way up, and you turn your volume down on the guitar, you get those really chimey sounds. Like, yeah, I remember hearing like I Can't Explain by The Who or something, and you just that's how you can get that sound.
Wait, run that by me again. What was it?
Yeah, a Tonebender, the old '60s Tonebender pedals, right, the Vox Tonebenders. You can turn the pedal all the way wide open, and then turn your volume down on your guitar until you get this really chimey, crystal clear, and it sounds like all those '60s. Cool Who sounds, and it sounds like Hendrix, and it sounds like, you know, you get these really hi-fi clean sounds from it. So I use that a lot, you know.
With I mean, obviously you're a big rock and roll fan. Do you have rock bands coming to you?
Oh yeah, yeah. I did this band. I've done this band Rival Sons, all their records.
And, oh, okay. Are they a Nashville band?
No, they're Long Beach.
Okay.
I don't know if you ever heard that singer, Jay Buchanan. He's a monster.
I know the name.
He's insane. And then I got to work with some of the guys from Deep Purple and
really?
Yeah.
On what?
I did a record with Glenn Hughes and Jason Bonham. They had a band together a couple years ago. And
Glenn Hughes can still belt it out.
He's
man.
A monster.
Yeah,
still to this day.
I was at a rehearsal out at Mates one day when he was jamming with, it was like him and the guitar player from Stone Temple Pilots.
Oh yeah, he played with those guys for a little bit.
Maybe,
right.
And a couple other people, I forget who it was, but it was like, and they were doing, it was all covers. And
yeah.
I was just listening through the wall going, oh my God, like Zeppelin covers and stuff that were perfect.
Oh yeah, yeah, he nails it. I did this band Houndmouth. They're kind of indie alternative. But I mean, that stuff is so natural to me, so natural,
right?
You know? The country stuff is something I'm still learning about, which is, that's why it's so fun to do it, you know?
Right.
So.
Well, cool, man. I mean, that's all the stuff I had to talk to you about, unless you have some burning desires that you want to tell the world. Right now is the time.
Nah, I got nothing.
Good. Thank you for taking the time to let me come by your place today.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you helping out.
Take care.
You are my sunshine.
Oh, yeah. Pearls of Wisdom by Mr. Dave Carr. Now, I don't know how active on social media Mr. Cobb is, but if you want to look for him, he's at DaveCobb7 on Twitter and Instagram. You can also find out all about Low Country Sound, his record label, at lowcountrysound.com. I don't think he has like a website for his own just personal thing, but maybe he does. I don't know. Check your Google. What a cool dude. That was a great interview. Loved it. And can't wait to go out there and make a record with that guy again someday. He is the best. Okay, now if you like what you hear on Walking the Floor, please go to the iTunes store and subscribe and leave some reviews and check out all the old interviews. There's a million of them up there. There's like, you know, Jason Isbell and Dwight Yoakam and Mike Ness and all kinds of cool people. So check it out. And that's it for this week. We'll be back next week with Whitey Morgan. That's right. Gonna put up my Whitey Morgan interview. We'll see you then. Adios, amigos!